When the Supreme Court issued the Citizens United decision that opened the floodgates for unlimited corporate spending to influence elections, the biggest impact was in a state where you might not expect, Montana. Since 1912, the state had a law on the books barring any corporate spending on political campaigns, but suddenly the money came pouring back in. Our next guest set out to tell the story of the money-politics nexus through the story of what happened there. Her new documentary is Dark Money. Kimberly Reed, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me here.
It probably would not occur to a lot of people to turn to Montana to tell the story of money in politics. How did you land in it as the setting for your documentary?
Well, first of all, I'm from there. So I was keeping an eye on the politics as they were evolving. I think like a lot of people, after I heard about Citizens United, I wasn't quite sure what to do about it. I mean, it was the law of the land. But in 2012, Montana was defending a century-old law that said that corporations could not, you know, engage in political campaigns. They couldn't give contributions to candidates for office. And when I saw that Montana was going to defend that law, it looked like it was going to go to the Supreme Court. It occurred to me as a filmmaker that this is a really good way to do the tough thing when you're talking about money and politics is to tell a story about people and not, you know, pie charts.
Yeah. Why don't you start with the background? So where did that 1912 law come from?
You know, there was actually quite a wave of progressive policies that were developed in the Mountain West states, probably most often because they were mining states. I'm thinking about like Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, places you don't think of as progressive bastions these days. But at the time, that's where a lot of the progressive movements were because they had a bunch of, migrant labor that was usually coming from the East Coast, working in the mines, and they started to organize when, they were being exploited. So that's when a bunch of laws in the Rocky Mountain West were developed, all of them about 100 years ago. And Montana's, after the 2010 Citizens United decision, was the only one that was standing. There was one, you know, where there was a kind of purplish state in this big sea of red of the Rocky Mountain West, and Montana decided that it should follow its own law, century-old law. It was actually called the Corrupt Practices Act of 1912. They were tired of the corruption that money was bringing to Montana politics. And after Citizens United, Montana decided to defend that law and claim that because of a unique situation, a unique set of circumstances in Montana, that that law should apply instead of Citizens United.
The unique circumstances, what are those?
The unique circumstances were, a lot of it goes back to the Copper Kings, the battle over what at the time was known as the richest hill on earth. That's a Butte, Montana. Basically electrified the nation was a phrase that they often used. There were several magnates who all had, you know, again, come from the East Coast and were fighting over control of the copper that was getting pulled out of Butte, Montana. And they had a smelter set up in Anaconda, and pretty soon these industrialists were basically running the state. One or the other of these copper kings owned all of the newspapers. They blatantly, openly bribed all of the elected officials. In fact, the reason we have a 17th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution today, which says that citizens elect their senators to U.S. Congress, they elect them directly. The reason we have that 17th Amendment is because of the corruption that was happening in Montana, because William A. Clark, one of those copper kings, decided that he wanted to have a Senate seat. He wanted to go to Washington. So he took out ads in his own newspapers offering to blatantly just bribe the legislators who were sitting in the Montana State House, offered to pay them $10,000 a vote to send him to Washington, D.C. And he actually won. He paid the money. He got the votes. He went to Washington, D.C. But once he got there, the rest of the senators were so disgusted with this corruption that was going on back in Montana that they refused to cede him. And ultimately that led to the 17th Amendment that led, you know, said that these state legislators were not going to elect senators. We need to open it up to the people and have direct elections.
And this is a history, I guess, that's more present in the mind of Montanans than maybe in other parts of the country. I mean, the residents of Butte literally live in the shadow of that copper mine today. It's a giant toxic pond of wastewater uphill from them.
Yeah,
that absolutely threatens their safety.
It's this constant reminder. And I think that, you know, there's not a lot of Montanans, and there's a lot of just really beautiful country there. So when you see this open sore in beautiful country, I think it just becomes this constant reminder of, you know, what happens when you do it wrong? What happens when you don't have responsible development? You know, what happens when corporate interests just run rampant and do whatever they want, pulling stuff out of the side of hills and don't take care of the land after that?
So fast forwarding to the present, to the post-Citizens United era, when it is still unclear what will become of Montana's law and corporate money and politics. The character that you choose to follow is an investigative journalist named John S. Adams. Here's a clip of him from the documentary.
I don't know who they are. I don't know how to fight them. I don't know how to argue with them. I can't debate them. I can't interview them. I can't pick up the phone and say, hey, what's your interest in candidate X? Because I don't know who they are. We'll never know.
So tell us a little bit about John S. Adams and why you chose to follow him as a character.
Yeah, at the time that John was actually saying that, he was actually working for the Gannett paper, one of the biggest papers in the state. And one of the first things that I did when I went back to Montana, where I grew up, where I'm from, I was living in New York at the time, was to dig in and follow the reporting that local journalists were doing. And there was a lot of really good reporting that was going on. There were three reporters in general, two for Lee newspapers, which, you know, had the five biggest cities in Montana. Mm-hmm.
And it's a chain infamous for cutting reporter jobs.
Yes, Lee newspapers. Yeah, look it up at Columbia Journalism Review and you'll see. But yeah, John was hot on the trail of this, and there were a couple others for Lee who were following it. And then within the space of a couple months, really, both Lee and Gannett, which is, you know, covers all of the major cities of Montana, both of those newspapers shut down their Capitol Bureau. So suddenly, now after having a lot of Montanans interested in following the money in politics and seeing what the impact was, all of a sudden there weren't any State House reporters. So John's story as an investigative reporter really became part of, you know, this much larger story about the Fourth Estate, about the role of a watchdog press and how crucial it is to have investigative reporters who are chasing down this money, who know how to follow the money, I guess is this phrase.
When the corporate money came back into Montana politics, who was spending it? What was it getting spent on?
That's the thing, is a lot of times it's really hard to tell. What the film tracks down is this game of whack-a-mole that happens as everybody's trying to figure out where the money is coming from and who's actually behind it. What was apparent at the time is that there was one organization, it was a 501c4, supposed to be a social welfare nonprofit organization, but it was spending a lot of money in politics. They were kind of the public face of everything. I'm going to avoid the spoiler list, but we ultimately track down these national groups that really don't have anything to do in Montana other than wanting to flip it from being a right-to-work state to, you know, flipping it from being a non-right-to-work state to being a right-to-work state. So at the end of the day, it was just really all about union busting.
And I'm going to translate that. States that are not right-to-work are states in which unions can form collective bargaining agreements in which everybody has to contribute dues if they're in the collective bargaining agreement. In a right-to-work state, people can opt out.
That's correct.
And it tremendously weakens the power of unions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, you go one step away from that, and it's maybe not even about this national organization's opinions on unions per se, but ultimately about just defunding the left.
Well, that's the main countervailing institutional force to corporate money in politics is money from unions. I mean, they're the only ones that spend a comparable amount generally on the other side of the ledger in politics.
That's right. That's right.
So I'm curious, like, it's clear that the money coming from the corporate sector is trying to push politics towards the Republican Party. I'm curious what kind of impact that had on the conduct of the actual politicians and elected officials. Did the political culture of Montana change?
It seemed to change overnight. There's a saying in Montana that it's just one really small town with super long streets. And if look at Montana on a map, and you'll see that the streets are really long. I mean, I think what happened in, it really started in 2008 when some of these techniques got pioneered and then exploded after Citizens United was passed in 2010, is that there was some decorum. There were some rules. There was a feeling that if you were going to attack someone in a negative way, you were going to put your name on it. And that changed with some of these social welfare nonprofits, these 501c4 nonprofits, which, are dark money groups is how the common term is coming to be used these days, that suddenly these groups, it seemed like there was a lot of coordination between different candidates, that all of a sudden all these different candidates were speaking from the same playbook and using the same postcard vendors that were using the same template, that were, you know, generating the same letters and handing out the same walk lists. And basically all of the intelligence, all of the apparatus that you need from a political consultant to run a political campaign, that all of a sudden these, 10, 15 candidates were all speaking from precisely the same playbook. And what also became apparent was that a couple interesting things, which is how these dark money groups work. Number one, it was usually in the primaries. And number two, they were almost always in safe Republican districts. So the purpose of what these C4 groups, these dark money groups were doing in these campaigns was not to elect, this Republican versus that Democrat. It was all about Republican on Republican in a primary in a safe district. So the aim of these campaigns was to select, which Republican you wanted in there. The other thing that was happening, too, is that there were a lot of people who were kind of popping up, not having long histories in the state, people coming from out of state. All of a sudden, these folks show up and seem to have a lot of money and support behind them, but nobody could tell where it was coming from. And that's, really the spy novel, the thriller story that our film tries to unwind is what those influences were and how that shell game was really working.
How would you describe the politics or the political persona of the typical Republican who had dark money lining up behind them in the primary?
I mean, the dark money was almost always, I think, exclusively supporting the candidate that was farther to the right. They were going after, moderate Republicans, business Republicans. And there wasn't even, the stated goal of ATP, the main C4 that we saw working, that we uncover in the film, the stated goal of that organization was to fight the radical environmentalist agenda. It had to do with environmental issues or development, extractive industries is how they always phrase it. And that had nothing to do with these questions about right to work, these questions about labor. They were also involved in a bunch of other issues and mailings, like a flood of postcards that were hitting everybody's mailboxes very suddenly, that had to do with Second Amendment, had to do with, size of government and taxation, had to do with life, right to life issues. And yes, it was all of this all of these other, this whole raft of social issues that were coming along with these campaigns, ostensibly from an organization that was there to fight the radical environmentalist agenda. Mm.
It's a fascinating story. Kimberly Reed, maybe we'll put a pin in it there before we spoil how it ends. Thank you so much for coming in to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kimberly Reed is the director of the new documentary, Dark Money. It will be opening July 27th in Bay Area theaters.